We will be loud and proud in this hour. Well, proud anyway. Or at least we'll get an idea of what being proud is about. We are definitely of two minds about the feeling of pride. On one hand, we want to feel pride in ourselves and in other people. On the other hand, some of us continue to identify pride as the worst of the seven deadly sins, a feeling that can turn horribly wrong for us. Jessica Tracy takes all this in her book, Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. Jessica Tracy is a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and the director of the UBC Emotion and Self Lab. Her work on pride has been published in journals including the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, and Evolution and Human Behavior, just to name a few. Jessica Tracy, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure enough. How did a sense of pride, or maybe a lack of it, kickstart your own career?
Well, yeah, in fact, I think it was a lack of it that did that. And I think this is pretty common. So for me, you know, I went to college and, you know, got a lot out of it. And then after I graduated, I sort of decided I needed a break. So I traveled across the country, moved to the West Coast, lived in San Francisco with some friends, worked at a cafe, and basically took some time to kind of enjoy life. And it was all going really well until after about a year or so, I just started to realize that something was missing. I wasn't having the same sort of satisfaction with myself and with my life that I'd been kind of accustomed to in college. And for me, what that meant was I needed to figure out what to do with my life to kind of find a sense of meaning in who I was, to figure out a way to get pride, basically, to feel good about myself in the ways that you do when you're kind of constantly working to achieve, as people in university tend to be. And so for me, that meant going back to grad school and getting a PhD in psychology.
Was that a straight line pretty much from realizing that you needed to feel some pride to studying pride as a subject matter?
No, not at all. When I started grad school, I knew I wanted to study emotions. And my graduate advisor was expert on the self and self-esteem. And so pride actually kind of came out because it was the intersection of those two areas, that it's an emotion that's all about the self and self-esteem and how we feel about ourselves. But it's clearly an emotion. It's not just the self. And interestingly enough, when I started grad school, almost no one had studied pride. There was very, very little research out there, which is sort of what you want to find as a grad student or researcher or, you know, adult researcher. You want to find that thing that seems really important, but for whatever reason kind of hasn't been touched on.
Why do you suppose science had sort of left pride off to the side?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. One is that historically emotions had kind of been left to the side. It really was only in the 1970s that psychologists started studying emotions at all, and that didn't really even take off until really the 80s and 90s. And I think part of that is because of sort of the Freudian history of emotions, that, you know, emotions were long considered these dysfunctional pathological instincts, and once modern social researchers sort of decided to kind of do away with Freudian ideas about psychology for the most part, everything that went with that was sort of shoved aside as well, and emotions were part of that. It took the work of Paul Ekman, who discovered that six emotions had universally recognized nonverbal expressions. That kind of is what changed things. That sort of is what allowed people to think, oh, maybe these aren't just pathological instincts. Maybe they're actually part of human nature. And that started this trend of research on emotions and what became known as the field of affective science. But even with that, pride was sort of left out, and that's because Ekman's work was very much focused on what he called the basic emotions, those emotions that are really fundamental to our sort of basic survival, things like anger, fear, disgust, happiness. Emotions like pride and shame, which are more about the self, they're a little bit more complex. Those emotions were really still left behind and not studied at all until really early in 2000, I'd say.
We have enjoyed talking about Paul Ekman and the facial action coding system here in The Exchange before. How did he test his theories on the universality of emotions and the expressions they produce?
Yeah, his work is really, really great, and it's super important. So what he did was he traveled back in 1969, I think, or 1967 originally. He made a couple trips, and he went to Papua New Guinea, and he found this tribe of people there known as the Four. And these were people who really were just about as cut off from the Western world as you could be. They lived in what's known as a small-scale traditional society. They sort of lived off the land, basically in the same way that their ancestors had kind of for millennia. And because they were on this island, you know, in Papua New Guinea, they really had no access to Western culture, right? There was no television, no movies, I don't think there was any mail, no way for them to learn about American or European culture, right? No magazines or anything like that. And so Ekman went to these people, and he brought images of emotion expressions from the West, Americans and Europeans showing different emotions, and he just showed them to these people and asked them to identify the emotions that they conveyed. And what he found was that, sure enough, the Papua New Guineans recognized all these emotions in the same way that Americans did. And that's really strong evidence for the claim that these emotions are universal, because it's very hard to sort of tell a story about how people separated, you know, geographically in such a strong way, culturally, how people could have developed separately the same exact way of expressing all these different emotions. The much more parsimonious explanation is that the reason people all over the world identify these emotions in the same way is because it's part of our human nature to do that.
So there's no pride face per se, I think you've already said. How did you test for it, though, at UC Davis?
Yeah, so pride, interestingly, and I think this is part of why Ekman didn't look at it, is because it's not just in the face. Pride is an expression that involves the body. We expand our posture, we push out our chest, we pull back our shoulders, we tilt our head up. We do smile, but we also smile with happiness. So that's not the part that's distinctive to pride. And what we did was actually, it ended up being pretty much the same as what Ekman did. And we started by just showing photos of this expression that we had other people pose to undergrads at UC Davis, as you say, where I was in grad school. And when we found that, sure enough, almost all of those people identified it as pride, we then said, okay, there's definitely something here. How far does it go? Is it just something that California college students know, or is it universal? And then we went and traveled to test whether it was universal.
And what'd you find out?
Well, when we didn't go to Papua New Guinea. We went to Burkina Faso, West Africa, which is also quite isolated because the poverty there, that people just live in such an extreme level of poverty, they really have no access to other cultures. And yet we found the same thing that Ekman did with his emotion expressions. The people there could recognize pride, and they identified it in the same way that Americans did.
Wow. Much more to talk about. Jessica Tracy's book is called Take Pride. We'll come back and take another look at the contents of the book and her research when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the psychologist Jessica Tracy, based at the University of British Columbia. She's the director of the UBC Emotion and Self Lab and the author of a recent book called Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. Pride is very useful to us, in addition to being highly criticized sometimes when other people explain or display too much of it. Join us on the Exchange with your thoughts about pride, maybe how it's affected your own life or how it's turned you off when other people displayed excesses of it. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So many of the other emotions are inborn. Is pride just part of our natural makeup, Jessica?
There's good evidence to suggest that, yes, it is. In addition to the study I was mentioning before the break, that people all over the world, including these highly isolated tribal villagers in West Africa, identify the expression in the same way, and that's really strong evidence for universality of the expression. We've also found that people all over the world spontaneously display this expression when they're feeling pride. And we did that by looking at the Olympics, which is a great way to kind of look at pride displays. Lots of pride shown in the Olympics, of course. But we did it with the judo competition in particular in the 2004 games. And the neat thing is we looked at people from all different cultures, and we found that no matter what country, no matter what culture people were from, they tended to show pride after they'd won a match. But then we looked at the Paralympics. And the nice thing about that is there's actually a blind judo competition. And so we can look at people who can't see, and in fact, we can even look at people who've never been able to see, because there's a sample of these individuals who are congenitally blind. They were born blind, so kind of inarguably have never seen a pride expression. They can't possibly have learned to show pride from watching others. And yet, when we look at just these people, we see the same thing. They also respond to success by displaying pride. Now, to me, that's pretty good evidence for innateness. It's really hard to come up with a story of how these people somehow learned to show it from all of their different cultures all over the world, despite never having been able to see it.
What would be the evolutionary advantage, though, for an emotion like pride? I mean, fear is pretty obvious. It keeps us from getting eaten, you know, and so many other things in our range of emotions that provide benefits to us in the creatures and environments we were tens of thousands of years ago. But how would pride help us?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what pride does for us is it helps us get status. And that's really important because status, it helps us get more resources. The higher status we are, the more likely we are to get things from other people in our group, the more likely other people are to give us what we want, the more influence we have over them. So there's a major survival and reproduction advantage to people who have higher status. And pride helps us get high status, and it does that in several ways. One way it does it is by motivating us to achieve. So the main reason that we work hard because we want to succeed is because we want to feel pride. And pride is really the kind of the carrot that we're looking for. It's this rewarding feeling because it's all about feeling good about the self, which is an incredibly positive feeling. As much as we might want to feel happiness, we want to feel pride even more. And in fact, we often sacrifice kind of simple pleasures, things that would bring us happiness, in order to get those pride feelings because it's so rewarding. And the reason that evolution made it so rewarding is because of the status benefit, that basically by making us want to do things that make us feel good about ourselves, evolution has made it so that we end up doing these things, and those things are exactly the things that end up getting us higher status.
So it seems like there's certainly differences in quantities of pride. What about in quality of it, though? Is there a difference between the quality you feel from emptying the dishwasher when the dishes are clean and dry versus what you would feel helping kids get scholarships by filling out applications?
Probably. You know, what I would say is that to feel pride, you sort of have to have it be about something that's really important to you. It has to be about a domain in which you have some sense of self based on. So, you know, for me, I don't really care about cooking. I'm not a good cook. So if I made something delicious, I might be happy because it would taste delicious, but I wouldn't, it's not, no part of myself is staked on that. So I wouldn't feel any particular sense of pride. For someone who is a cook and really kind of sees himself in that way, they're going to feel a great deal of pride for making a delicious meal. And so, you know, while I'd say, sure, everyone's going to feel more pride from helping someone get a scholarship than emptying the dishwasher, I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think that if your job is to be a dishwasher and for whatever reason you're able to take a great deal of pride in doing that job really well, maybe it's because, you know, that job is what allows you to provide for your family, you're helping support your children, you're helping support your partner, and the way that you're doing that is by being the best dishwasher, then absolutely, I think you could feel a lot of pride in that.
Jessica Tracy, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Take Pride. There's a great example, a couple of great examples in here, actually, of people in history. Paul Gauguin, the famous Impressionist painter, is one of them. This is sort of an extreme case, though, isn't it?
You know, he's an extreme example of something that I think is pretty common. So, you know, the reason I talk about Paul Gauguin in the book is because he was this businessman in Paris, and he was sort of a stockbroker. He was making money, supporting his family, and sort of living the typical Parisian bourgeois life. And he hated it, and he basically couldn't stand it, and he was constantly sneaking off to the kind of bohemian corners of Paris, learning about this nascent art world that was really kind of exciting there. And eventually he decided he couldn't live the life that he was living with his wife and five children in suburban Paris, or the suburbs of Paris, and had to become an artist. And that meant leaving his wife, leaving his children, leaving his job. He spent years starving on the streets of Paris, eventually moved to Panama. He lived this incredibly tough life from a physical perspective, but it was the life that he needed to live in order to experience his full sense of self and take pride in the person that he really wanted to be, which it turned out was this amazing painter. So he's a great example, both because he made such a dramatic switch in his life, he gave up so much in order to do that, but also because, of course, he became one of the world's most famous artists. But there's lots of examples of this. I think it happens more often than we might think. Another example I give in the book is someone who isn't quite as famous, but still has gained some recognition, Dean Karnazes, who's known as the Ultramarathon Man. He wrote a memoir called Ultramarathon Man, and he tells the story in his book about something pretty similar. He was a businessman doing very well. He'd, you know, sort of been successful, hardworking his whole life. And then when he turned 30, he realized that something was missing, that he was living a life that didn't give him the real sense of satisfaction that he needed. And what I would call that,
it was a rather sudden onset of this feeling, too. I mean, it happened some night in a bar in San Francisco.
You know, I think my guess, that's how he tells the story. My guess is that it had been, you know, sort of coming to a head for a while. He tells, you know, the story about how he was a runner, and athletics and running and pushing himself to extremes was an incredibly important part of who he was as a child and a high school kid. And then his life changed. And part of the reason his life changed was because his sister died, and I think that made him kind of seek out a more secure life, very understandable. But it led him to do things that maybe were less representative of who his true self was. And, you know, I do think this is how this kind of thing happens, that it often takes major life events, turning points, like turning 30, which for a lot of people is a big kind of sign of, okay, now I'm an adult. What am I doing with my life? Where is my life going? Now's the time to figure out if it's going in the direction that I want it to be going. And for him, that's absolutely what happened. He woke up that morning and felt, whoa, I don't want to be turning 30 because this is not where my life is going. And, you know, it's funny, I often think that's the case when people have a hard time with big milestone, age milestones like that. Sometimes it's about aging issues, but just as often I think it's sort of about, well, wait a minute, here I am turning 30, 40, 50, and this isn't the life that I wanted. And that's why it's then hard to turn that age, not necessarily because we're scared of aging per se, but because it's kind of a reminder that, well, wait a minute, I'm living this life that isn't giving me a sense of pride.
I've reached X times 10, and I haven't achieved the things I thought I would when I was 10.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So in Dean Karnazes's case, though, I mean, did he run 50 marathons in 50 days? Is that what I read?
Yeah, he did. He's done amazing feats. It's pretty incredible.
But honestly, is it pride that drives him or masochism?
Right. So, I mean, this is a great question. And, you know, far be it for me to say that pride is the only thing that drives him to do this. Certainly, there's some ability to tolerate and maybe even welcome pain in his case. I also think, you know, anytime you're doing something athletic like that, there's a sense of excitement involved. And parts of the running probably are really fun. However, what I would argue is that to get to that level of achievement and that level of endurance, and this is true not just for someone who runs 50 marathons in 50 days, but someone who runs one marathon in one day, or, you know, depending on your fitness level, someone who runs a 5K, I really don't believe that people would be motivated to do that, because what that requires is subjecting yourself to pain when you could be experiencing pleasure, right? You could be lying on the couch watching TV, very pleasurable. Instead, you're going to go out and subject yourself to pain. And I think you need an emotion to motivate you to do that. We don't just do that kind of thing because we think to ourselves, this is a good thing to do. We only engage in behaviors like that because we experience a feeling that motivates us to. And there's really only one emotion that can motivate us to do something like that that really requires us to endure a lot of pain, give up pleasure. And the reason that we do that is because of this greater good we know we're going to get at the end, which is that really intense sense of pride.
Pride is the subject matter here on the Jefferson Exchange in this hour. Jessica Tracy is a psychologist at the University of British Columbia, the director of the UBC Emotion and Self Lab, and the author of the new book, Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success, So It Drives Us to Bigger and Better Things. There's some flip sides we'll get to as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Share a story of pride from your own life and how it motivated you, or maybe a story on how pride made you go over the edge and it turned into something else, like hubris. We'll be talking about that coming up. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone. By email is jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to Paul Gauguin for a second because I think he might be a demonstration of hubris here. He pretty much turned off all of his friends by the end of his life, hadn't he?
Yeah, no, he lost a lot, for sure. Now, it's interesting you say that might be an example of hubris. It might be. It's hard to know. I think, you know, we just don't know enough about, it's, you know, having had this happen so long ago, it's hard to say whether he displayed evidence of hubristic pride, but you're absolutely right. Pride can veer into a different form. You know, we distinguish between two kinds of pride. We call the pride that I think you and I have largely been talking about authentic pride, and that's the pride that really motivates us to want to succeed. But then there is this other kind of pride, which is hubristic pride. And we found that these are two very different things. They're different emotional experiences. They feel different. The people who tend to feel them are different from each other. So they have different sort of associations with personality. And they motivate different kinds of behavior. So hubristic pride doesn't really motivate people to achieve. If anything, it's almost sort of like when you feel hubristic pride, you want to rest on your laurels because you have the sense of sort of greatness about yourself that's a little bit inflated, a little bit grandiose, and driven in part by a defensiveness. Part of why people feel hubristic pride is because deep down, at sort of an unconscious, implicit level, they have insecurities and don't really believe that they're good enough or great enough. And the way they compensate for that is by feeling and displaying signs of hubristic pride. But then the result is the last thing you want is to put in more effort and try to succeed again, because that's a risk, right? Here are people who are insecure and think, maybe I won't succeed. So instead what they do is sort of rest on their laurels and say, I'm just great and I'm going to focus on the praise that I'm getting right now.
Well, so Dean Karnazes, for example, could have stopped a long time ago and, and bragged a little bit, but he continues to do what he's doing.
Yeah, no, he's a great example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that is kind of the key to avoiding hubris, is to sort of not take time or not take too much time to stop and celebrate the achievements. You know, maybe a little time is okay, but very quickly after the celebration, kind of move on to say, okay, what's the next achievement? How did I, you know, what's the next thing I need to do to maintain the sense of self that I want?
So now, obviously, through history, we've had different feelings about pride. I mean, in one case, it's something that you need and makes you feel good and all that sort of stuff and motivates you to better things. But then it's also, as the subtitle of the book reminds us, considered the deadliest sin. And what was it that Dante assumed would happen to people who are prideful in life?
I think he said that you'd have to be forced to, in purgatory, I guess, carry a stone slab that pushes your head down, I think, forever, I guess. And, you know, I think it's interesting because it is related to the pride expression, where you can imagine if a stone slab is on your back or your neck, the back of your neck is pushing your head down, that's preventing you from showing the pride expression, which is sort of the opposite of that. It's this expansive display. So it's a pretty terrible punishment.
Yeah, so you can't puff out your chest and do all the
right.
things other than the
right,
pride
exactly.
expression.
Yeah.
So you do riff for a while on narcissists. I mean, are they more likely to carry pride in a boastful way?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So narcissists are people who basically, instead of just feeling a genuine sense of confidence or self-worth, the sense of self that they have is inflated. It's exaggerated. It's sort of grandiose. They think not just that they're good, but that they're great and typically better than everyone else around them. And there's a good deal of evidence to suggest that this is driven, like I was saying, by these unconscious insecurities, that it's a defensive process. It's something that people do to make themselves feel better about themselves when deep down maybe they don't feel so good about themselves. And narcissists absolutely are the people who tend to feel hubristic pride. And I think hubristic pride is, to a large extent, the emotion that sort of fuels and drives narcissism. It's the emotion that kind of keeps narcissists going, basically.
So because they feel a lack, they tend to compensate through this bragging kind of pride.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for people with at least adequate self-esteem, is the expression of pride different? Or is the pride expression pretty universal?
It seems to be universal, and interestingly, you know, we've always thought, well, maybe authentic and hubristic pride are going to have two different nonverbal expressions, and so far we haven't found that to be the case, that, you know, if you show people different versions of the expression, you know, sometimes people's arms are raised above their head, sometimes they're sort of what we call an akimbo position at their sides with their hands on hips, and we show people different versions, and we say, okay, is this person feeling, you know, authentic pride, by which we mean confidence and a sense of self-worth, or is this person feeling hubristic pride, by which we mean arrogance and egotism and conceitedness? On average, we kind of get about 50-50, right? Half the people will say one, half the people will say the other. We don't see any real clear convergence of opinion, which tells us that there isn't a distinct expression associated with either facet. Or I should say, if there is, it's very subtle, the differences between the two, that the basic pride expression can be identified as either. And so what that means is that people probably interpret pride expressions and figure out which kind of pride people are feeling by figuring out things like, who is this person? What's their personality like? Why are they feeling pride? Is this a situation in which it's appropriate to show this display? Are they being arrogant by showing this display? And when they have information like that, then people absolutely can make an accurate judgment about which kind of pride it is.
Jessica Tracy's our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Take Pride. You ran a project at UC Davis, I see, looking for the terms that people associate with pride. How did that illuminate your work?
Well, that's kind of how we figured out that there are these two different kinds of pride. It was really interesting. We sort of just began by asking people to list words. So tell us all the words that you think of when you think of pride. And then we did a version of that where we had people, like I said, look at the pride expression and list words. So what words do you think characterize this expression? And we kept seeing these two very different sets of words. And we used various statistical analyses to figure out whether they were, in fact, two separate kinds of words. And that's exactly what we found. All these analyses showed that they sort of all clustered in two sort of clumps, very distinct clumps. And one includes words like productive, achievement, accomplished, successful, confident. And then the other includes things like conceited, arrogant, egotistical, superior. And it turns out these are very separate feelings. And, you know, the good one, the authentic pride, tend to have different personalities from people who feel hubristic pride. People who feel authentic pride, for example, tend to be extroverted, they're conscientious, they're hardworking, they like to help others, they tend to be empathic, they care about others, and they tend to be well-liked, and they have a lot of good friends and positive relationships. In contrast, people who tend to feel hubristic pride, they typically are disagreeable, sometimes aggressive and manipulative. They're more likely to engage in sort of petty misbehaviors, like petty crimes or lying or cheating. And they often are disliked. They don't have good relationships. They often have few close friends. And people tend not to really like them. So really two different kinds of emotional experiences.
So it is consistent within the person. It's not like you just get too much of the authentic pride that turns into hubristic pride. It's kind of in your own makeup, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's absolutely the case, I think, that you could have a lot of authentic pride and then eventually shift into hubristic pride. But no, it's not the case that just the more authentic pride you get, eventually you reach a threshold level, and then because you have so much of it, now it's hubristic pride. That doesn't seem to be the case. It's actually a real qualitative difference. And yeah, you know, in general, people can be prone to one or the other. However, you could also be prone to both or prone to neither.
Okay, we'll talk about the people who are prone to neither. That's a good place to pause right here. We'll take a break on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Jessica Tracy, psychology professor at the University of British Columbia, about her book, Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. So using pride for better purposes for ourselves and for humankind at large will be our discussion topic in the next segment. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange and take some phone calls and emails from you when we return in a minute 25. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Jessica Tracy, psychology professor at the University of British Columbia. She's the director of the UBC Emotion and Self Lab and the author of a book on pride, which she's been studying for many years now. The book is called Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your own questions and stories and maybe some examples from your own life or people around you anyway of expressions of pride. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So a couple of different pivots to turn on here. Number one is that there are two facets to pride. It could be authentic or hubristic. Now, what about the absence of pride? Is there a name for the emotion we feel when we just don't feel prideful?
You know, I mean, on the one hand, it could be shame. And so that's not just not feeling prideful. That's actually feeling bad about ourselves. And it's a pretty intense emotional experience. But, you know, we can also sort of be aware of the lack of pride. And I think that's sort of what we were talking about before, that maybe Gauguin felt and that I think Dean Karnazes felt, that led them to change their lives, right? That when you're sort of aware of the fact that I'm living my life, everything's fine, I'm meeting all my basic needs, but I'm just not doing anything that makes me really feel good about myself. And that can be very motivating.
So are there ways in which, I mean, if we think we're sliding into hubristic pride, are there ways to put the brakes on? Have you researched that part?
So we haven't done a lot of work in terms of, you know, how people can actually modify their hubristic pride. But, you know, there are studies out there suggesting that when you feel hubristic pride and when you show it, there are going to be some negative consequences as well as positive. You know, on the positive side, narcissists can be very charming. They can get a lot of attention at first. When you first meet them, they tend to be popular. People like them at first, although over time they tend to like them a lot less. And hubristic pride does get you power. We found that it's linked to this form of attaining status known as dominance, which is basically a way of getting high status that involves being aggressive and intimidating and essentially convincing others to give you power because they're sort of afraid not to. And you can see all kinds of examples of this. It's typically people who have control over some valuable resource. Maybe it's money, maybe it's, you know, something else that the group values. It might just be that they're physically bigger and stronger. And they use that power in an aggressive and manipulative way and sort of force other people to give them the influence that they want. And hubristic pride seems to feed this. Feeling that emotion, feeling the sense of superiority and arrogance and willingness to put others down and be aggressive, that's exactly what's sort of needed to attain a reputation of dominance, which, like I said, can be an effective way of getting power. Now, that said, people who get dominance and people who display hubristic pride are not well-liked, right? They get power, but the people who give them power don't really want to, and they don't like them, and they don't choose to give them power. They only do it because they're afraid not to.
So in addition to all the research you do with students and people who come to the lab, I mean, how much do you look in the world around? I mean, there's certainly lots of cases of people expressing pride in the world at large to be had with a few clicks on the internet. How much are you looking out there at celebrities and politicians and the like?
Yeah, we've done stuff with that. I think there's lots of, like you said, lots of great examples. You know, I mentioned before the athletes. We've done a lot of work looking at Olympic athletes and how they show pride. But yeah, you know, politicians are another great example of kind of seeing how people use pride to get power, because that's kind of what politicians do, right, is figure out ways to use their pride effectively. And it's really interesting because it is such a fraught domain, given that pride can be hubristic pride. And I think, you know, the best way to do this as a politician is to convey a sense of authentic pride. You certainly want to do that. If you don't do that, then you're not going to be seen as the person who deserves high status, right, if you can't convey a sense of, I am authentically proud in my successes. But at the same time, if you veer over into hubris, well, then you can lead to sort of dominance. And some politicians have taken that route, but many prefer not to. Yeah, not naming any names.
Of course not. Are the rules different depending on profession, though? I mean, can you come across like somebody who's full of hubristic pride as a pro wrestler, and if you tried that same thing as a politician, you wouldn't get away with it?
That's really interesting, yeah. No, I think that's absolutely the case. And it varies, you know, from culture to culture and society to society. Different domains allow for different levels of hubristic pride. And, you know, I think here in Western culture and North American society, we're pretty tolerant of hubristic pride, almost shockingly so, that we sort of laugh it off. If people brag too much, it often doesn't bother us, or maybe it bothers us a little bit, but we still find them impressive. And that might have to do something to do with our sort of extreme individualism and focus on achievement and that kind of thing. If you go to other cultures that are less individualistic, you don't see that kind of acceptance of bragging at all. You know, and at the other extreme, there's studies on egalitarian, small-scale traditional societies where you have sort of bushmen who, if they have a great success, like a big kill in the hunt, they won't talk about it. Because if they talk about it, they're considered so horribly prideful, they're sort of kicked out of the group. So instead, they actually have to say, you know, no, nothing really happened today. I didn't really have anything big. And only by saying that will their peers say, oh, he had a big kill. So it's this whole kind of game that they play in order to avoid being seen as hubristic.
But, so that brings up an interesting point about whether pride can truly be pride if it is not at all expressed. I mean, can you feel enormous pride and just sort of have a, you know, neutral exterior?
Yeah, no, I think you can. I think regulating our emotions to fit with social norms and social needs is actually really important. And, you know, you can regulate your emotions by not feeling them, and we can do that with mixed success depending what the emotion is. Studies have shown that, you know, for example, if I'm looking at a video of a finger amputation, I say that because that's the example these studies often use, I'm going to be horribly disgusted. I'm pretty prone to disgust anyway with that kind of thing. But if I think about it in a cognitive way and sort of think, well, what if I'm a doctor just watching this to learn about it? I can tamp down my actual feelings of disgust. Or I can watch it without thinking that, but I can control my expression of disgust. I can be feeling really disgusted, but avoid showing other people in my face how disgusted I am. And there's different reasons to do each of these, you know. And in the case of pride, I would say it's good to experience authentic pride. There are benefits to doing that. And so I wouldn't, you know, encourage people to avoid that experience, because I think, you know, if you do that, you're not going to get the benefits that we really all want to get from achievement. And that really is sort of the reason that we all try to have achievements. But we do need to, you know, sort of suppress our nonverbal expression of pride sometimes. There are situations in which it's very appropriate to show pride, and we should show pride. And we will benefit from doing that. You know, we have studies that have shown that when people see pride displays in others, they have this automatic inference to see them as high status. And they can't help but make that inference. If they try not to, they still make it. So there's benefits to showing pride, but there's also disadvantages, because these people, if they're seen as showing pride in a situation where it's not appropriate or unwarranted, then they become disliked. So it's really about kind of knowing the situation, knowing whether it's an okay situation to show it, and then showing it maybe in moderation, being conscious of how much you're displaying it, how you're talking about it, who's around you. You know, if your success depends on others' failures and those others are around, it's probably not a good idea to express a lot of pride in that particular situation, for example.
All right, so a lot of it does fall on perception, too, of the people who are observing. And I noticed that, you know, some people can think that a person looks satisfied, and another person can think that same person looks smug.
Yeah, you know, with the pride display, we find that people do say, yeah, this is pride, but you're right, they won't necessarily, the same two different people won't necessarily see it as the same kind of pride. And you're right, some people will see a pride expression as more hubristic and arrogant, other people will see it more as they're just, you know, feeling a sense of accomplishment and confident, and that will depend on the person doing the perceiving as well as the person doing the displaying. The more that we know about the expressor, that's also going to influence those judgments.
All right, a call here from Derek in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jessica Tracy, the author of Take Pride.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Just a couple, one observation and one quote to relay is that if two people go fishing and you ask how the fishing was, if the answer is we caught 20 fish versus I caught 20 fish, you can kind of discern who did most of the catching whenever two people fishing. And then the quote that I really love from Bill Belichick was, when you lose, say little. When you win, say even less. Just wanted to share that. Enjoy the program. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that, Derek. Appreciate that. That's some interesting comments from particularly about Bill Belichick as a Patriots fan.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. And it's funny, if you win, I think if you win in a situation where everyone knows that you won, for the most part, playing down your pride is only going to benefit you. You're already going to get the status gain because they know that you won. So, you know, showing excessive pride in that situation could really backfire. That said, showing no pride in that situation is also problematic because then you're not responding in a genuine way, right? If someone wins a huge, you know, say an Olympic medal and doesn't show any pride, observers might say, what's going on here? Why is he not feeling pride about this? Is he hiding something? And so that's not good either.
Is there a gender break in expressing pride? Do people think that women are weirdos if they act in the same way that men would in a similar situation?
You know, that's a great question. Yeah, so in all our studies, we almost never find gender differences just in terms of recognition. So the pride expression is reliably recognized when it's shown by men and women. It's displayed, you know, by men and women, although men do, I think, probably display it more. We don't exactly have data on that, but that's my guess. But in the Olympic study I mentioned, we didn't find any difference in the tendency to display pride between the genders, so women were just as likely in that particular situation, winning an Olympic medal, to show pride as men were. But absolutely, I think there's a different reaction to men and women showing pride. And there's a neat study, actually, that just came out that showed that when women display pride, there's actually some benefits that come to them because, in general, women are perceived as less agentic and more communal, more sort of relationship-oriented than men are. But when they display pride, those differences go away. So basically, women come to be seen as equally agentic and no more communal than men. And you could say that, well, that's a benefit in the sense of they're seen as equally agentic, or maybe it's not a benefit because it's nice that women are seen as more communal. So, you know, I'm not sure what the long-term outcomes or the consequences of that are, but it is interesting that the pride display can get rid of that, you know, otherwise kind of normative gender difference that people perceive.
Let's take another call from Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange with Jessica Tracy.
Good morning. Such an incredibly fascinating subject that we all deal with every day.
Indeed.
One of the questions I have, or observations, is as a person who has competed in the sense of sports, music, etc., through my life, as well as had a job that was highly reviewable, that is, everything I did could be seen by other persons in a large work environment, it seems that pride was tied so much with my own awareness of my own competence. In other words, if I won a game or a match and the other person was just not very good or not feeling well or something, yes, I won a match, but it doesn't have the same impact as if I lost, for example, against a much more difficult person and I played well. And so pride or expression of pride seemed to be more tied to my awareness of my own moment of a victory over something small or large rather than the actual event itself.
Okay, thanks. Good perceptions. Thanks for those, Connie. Appreciate that. What do you make of that, Jessica?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think pride absolutely works that way. The caller is totally right. And actually many emotions work that way, that really emotions are triggered not by, you know, concrete events, but by how we think about those events. And emotion researchers call this an appraisal, the way that we interpret a particular event. So something that seems scary to a lot of people might not elicit fear if you don't appraise it as threatening or scary. And in the same way, something that seems like, well, objectively, that's an success, you should feel pride. Well, no, if you don't appraise it as, this is about myself, this is about me having some big accomplishment that makes me feel good about myself, if you don't have that appraisal, you're not going to feel pride. It absolutely is the way that we interpret these kinds of events.
Can we become pride junkies? Can we seek it out so much that we actually end up hurting ourselves? And yes, I am thinking of Dean Karnazes.
That's interesting. Well, you know, my sense is that pride junkie thing would be more hubristic pride. And, you know, Lance Armstrong is sort of the example I think of there, where my guess is he was working really, really hard to feel authentic pride early in his life when he just, you know, was this unbelievable biker, spending hours and hours and hours as a teenager and a young man on his bike, which, you know, is just as hard as running marathon after marathon. But then got too attached to the feeling of pride that he got from other people's praise and from winning. And so he found an easier way to get those feelings than working so hard on his bike. And not to say that he didn't keep working hard when he was doping, but he clearly was taking a different route. And I think that's because he became focused on the pride, which turned into hubristic pride, rather than the getting there, rather than, I want to be the fastest cyclist in the world, it became, I want to be seen by others as the fastest cyclist in the world. And that's a really critical difference, right? Because if you're cheating, you really can't know if you're the fastest cyclist in the world. So he ended up doing something that sort of prevented him from actually accomplishing what was probably his original goal, which is a little bit ironic, but I think that's how hubristic pride works.
All right. We've learned a lot about pride today, both hubristic and authentic, and, of course, the things we can feel, and we feel neither of those. Shame is one of them. A lot going on here. It's a lot in the book, Jessica. Thanks for joining us to talk about this.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Jessica Tracy, professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and director of the UBC Emotion and Self Lab. The book is called Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success.